We have now arrived at a stage where the discussion approaches the concept and the constitution of the supermind. Naturally, these portions are somewhat stiff because they deal with areas which are not familiar to the human thought as it has developed so far. Still, we shall try our best to understand and assimilate, at least in substance, what he has described. Perhaps those of you who have read Life Divine would detect some differences in his description of this supermind and its workings in the synthesis and what he has written later on in the second volume of Life Divine. That was inevitable, and Sri Aurobindo himself wanted to revise and recast what he had written, particularly in the later chapters, but that was not to be. However, what has been written gives us an idea of the labor ahead, and the present chapter which we are to study today deals with the nature of supermind. The supermind is the goal of the integral yoga, and the supermind, as you know, is not something that is higher than mind, some kind of magnified mind, but it is a consciousness or a truth will which is clearly above the highest domains of the mind. The highest levels are the overmind, the overmental levels. Even beyond those levels are those of the supermind. The supermind also has its gradations, number of gradations, and the seeker has to ascend them step by step. The integral yoga, which aims to realize the truth of the supermind, means a radical change of consciousness. Consciousness in the mind, in the heart, in the life regions, life energies, and even in the physical, down to the subconscious. And such a radical change of consciousness as this cannot be achieved by any of the traditional paths of yoga. That is why, out of decades of experience and realization, he has chalked out what we today call the integral yoga. In other words, it is called the yoga of perfection. And this yoga of perfection, which you have traced so long, go step by step, beginning with purification of the instrumental being, the mind, the emotions, the life energies, the physical energies. Purification followed by liberation of the self from the knots of nature. And once this liberation is achieved in a certain measure, an attainment of equality, a spirit of equality which receives things, which receives impacts of life with a certain detachment and equanimity. All these prepare the being for the action, direct action of the divine Shakti, the divine power. Even today, the action goes on, but indirectly, through several inferior formulations of that Shakti in ignorance. But the action of the direct action of the Shakti can take place after the preliminary steps of the path of perfection have been taken. And with the action of the higher Shakti proceeding apace, the perfection of the instruments, the perfection of the instrumental nature becomes possible. Till then, however much we may purify, however much we may discipline them, there is always an element of ignorance, there is always an element of inconscience and nations pulling them down and diluting the working of the higher Shakti. But as the direct action proceeds, the instruments shed their past legacy and they are given a new term and set to working in new dimensions. Perfection of the instruments becomes possible. But through what medium is this divine Shakti to operate? As things stand, it is through our mind that it has to act. A mind is the highest faculty so far evolved by nature, and naturally it has to act through the mind. But mind as it is it equal to the situation? Obviously the reply is no. The mind is inadequate. What is required to function as an unsullied and uninterfering instrument of the divine Shakti is a kind of mind, let us say, which is receptive to the truth, which expresses the truth, which embodies in a certain measure the truth, that is the aim, and also wields the will to translate this truth into action or to express it, to manifest it. Our normal human mind is far, far from being able to discharge these functions. It is only what Sri Aurobindo calls the Gnostic mind, the mind that is bathed in truth knowledge, established in truth power, that can function as the effective instrument of the divine Shakti. And this Gnostic mind is what is called Vijnana in the ancient Indian system, what Sri Aurobindo calls the supermind. What is the fundamental nature of this supermind? If it has to replace our evolving human mind and function as the leader of evolution, we should understand what is its nature, fundamental nature, in which it differs both in nature and functioning from our mind. In the first place, the knowledge that is natural to the Gnostic mind is a knowledge by identity and oneness. The mind that our knowledge commands is, after all, a kind of separated or separative knowledge. The mind holds itself separate from the object of knowledge, studies it as something other than itself, and arrives at a certain formulation of perception, constructs a structure of what it calls knowledge, and the approach being from outside, we can be pretty sure that the knowledge is not the full or the complete knowledge of the object. It we know only as much as our mind can skim on the surface of what it holds to be separate. But the Gnostic mind does not have to seek for this kind of knowledge with the aid of logic, with the aid of reasoning, with the aid of sense data, as our mind does. It has a faculty, a special faculty, of embracing, of becoming one, of comprehending the object of knowledge. In fact, at that level, there is not this distinction between the knower, the known, and the link of knowledge. There is a oneness of consciousness. Some idea, though not the full idea, can be had from the analogy of ourselves knowing what goes on within us. We become angry, we become happy. We know we are happy. How? We do not separate. This is separate from myself. There is a certain identity at a deeper level, and by oneness, the knowledge is natural. I know I am happy, I know I am angry. I don't need to convince myself with logical aids. I don't need to study. I have only to look at it and I know what I am. Similarly, though in a different way, the knowledge of identity and of oneness that the Gnostic mind commands at all times is its natural and most important position. It does not have to concentrate upon an object, assess it, go round and round, but has only to direct its gaze, and immediately the knowledge comes. The knowledge doesn't come that way, but at a deeper level, my consciousness and the consciousness in the object, they become one. The moment I want to know, that consciousness comprehends the consciousness that is in that object, and that yields its knowledge content to my comprehending consciousness. The whole thing takes place in a split second, because the operation does not work according to our mechanical rules. It is a direct position, a direct seizure of the knowledge of the truth. And the poise of the Gnostic mind being this, it is natural that the awareness that all is one, that the spirit is one everywhere, the oneness of creation, the oneness of forms, oneness at every level, is a self-evident truth to the Gnostic mind. To our mind, we have to convince it that all matter, for instance, is one. My body is constituted of matter. The bodies of all are constituted of matter. So, at that level, all of us are born of the same matter, constituted in body of the same matter, and we are one. So too, at the level of life, we all breathe the same life force, are filled with the same life force. It is the same life energy, the universal ocean of life energy that flows into all of us. There also we are one. So too, in the mental plane, the mental energy, there is a one universal mind of which all of us, our minds, are so many self-postings. So also spiritually, The mind has to be convinced again and again till it gains a settled conviction that all is one, the world is one. Behind all the various multiplicity of forms, there is oneness of spirit which expresses itself at every level. This knowledge is natural to the supermind or the Gnostic mind. Sri Aurobindo adds a note of caution in pursuing the analogy of subjective knowledge too far as the supermind is concerned. I said that we become aware of myself becoming angry, of myself becoming happy and all that. But even that is not that gulf, that distinction between myself and my mind and my body. The part in me that knows and the part that is known, even that gulf, however slender, does not obtain at the supramental level. The second characteristic is that the knowledge is a total knowledge. The mind can only collect bits of knowledge, fragments of knowledge. It can know one thing at a time. And what it knows, it may know thoroughly to that extent. But things other than what we know, the knowledge that we know, it is not aware of. That is why the mind is a seeker of knowledge, and the knowledge that it acquires are only fragments of knowledge. The supermind, the Gnostic mind, has a total knowledge. And what is this totality? Not certainly the whole world only. The totality of which the Gnostic mind is in possession, the knowledge, is the reality of the individual, the reality of the universe, the reality of the transcendent. So all these, the whole totality of the scheme, it knows. It knows not only vertically, but it also knows horizontally. This integral nature of knowledge is again a special characteristic of the Gnostic mind. Our mind is not capable of it. We can conceive of the individual being at its core a real formation, a formation of the reality. The mind can also conceive that the individual can merge in the universal. But at the same time, to think of the transcendent and relate itself to the transcendent is a thing which is not natural to the mind. Though the mind may have that faith, but it is not natural for the fragmenting mind to have a total knowledge. Third, the Gnostic mind is directly truth conscious. It does not have to proceed through grades of knowledge, through various stages of understanding to arrive at truth. The Gnostic mind, being constituted itself directly from the operations of the supramental consciousness, it is conscious of the truth directly. Our mind can conceive of truth, but it is not directly conscious of truth. It has to pass through so many grades. It has to break through so many walls of ignorance and shadows of ignorance. And the background of a mind, which is the background of error because of its origins, the consciousness, the mental consciousness not having fully evolved, there is always the element of error, there is always the element of limitation, restriction, leading to the mental structure being a limited and not always a reliable structure. The supermind, Sri Aurobindo points out, is not only the knower but also the creator. It knows, but with what it knows, it has the power, it wields the power to create, to manifest that knowledge in form, in movement. The mind knows, but what it knows, it is not in a position to fully render in terms of manifestation. But here, both the truth that the supermind knows and the will that is the power of that truth are in perfect balance, unlike in the mind where there may be knowledge but power may lack, and to that extent the knowledge remains ineffective, impotent. It may happen that the mind may have the power, the dynamism, but it may lack the knowledge to back up the power, which leads to an anarchic use of that power. This defect is not there in the realms of the supermind. There, truth and will are evenly balanced. And in the higher grades, Sri Aurobindo points out, that there, it is wrong to speak even of them as two things, truth and will. Truth and will fuse into one. Truth is an aspect and will is another aspect. Or to put it more simply, it is truth as will. It's not truth and will, but truth as will. There is absolutely no conflict, possibility of conflict between knowledge and power in the supermind. Wherever the supermind works, this combination of knowledge and will being effective, things are always kept in line with the vision behind. A thing is intended to take a particular line of operation, and the knowledge will behind it sees to it that the same thing is followed. And it is a reflection of this truth that has led to what we call the perception of karma, necessity, fate. At our level, what we understand as faith, necessity and karma, it has a truth behind it, and that truth is every manifestation being divine, the divine truth power basing and conducting every movement in creation, necessarily that truth power sees to it that the thing follows the idea behind the thing. And this imperious compulsion of truth gives a certain element of determination to movements in manifestation. We call it karma, we call it necessity, which we can't escape, we call it fate, which governs us. Naturally, the concept, the significance of fate, necessity and karma changes once we understand this truth behind these concepts. They are not mechanical determinants, but they are original, luminous and conscious determinants of all that goes on in the creation. This vision, this knowledge will, has before it mapped out, as it were, in one vision, the past, the present and the future. Our mind can know only what is before it. It can recall by memory a secondary operation of what has gone before. It can perhaps imagine what is going to be the future, but it can be sure of nothing. But the Gnostic mind has the entire stretch out of time, past, present and future, mapped out before it. And so it may take what we call its own time to effectuate what has been conceived, what has been embodied in the real idea. There is no compulsion of time, human time, as far as the Gnostic mind is concerned.
Is the Gnostic mind capable of making distinction between past, present and future?
It can. The Gnostic mind, as you will see later, has two operations, the comprehending action and the apprehending action. We are now speaking of the comprehending action. When it chooses to know point-wise, section-wise, part-wise, it changes its mode. That is what it undergoes, an apprehending movement of knowledge. That we will come to later on. So this truth will is experienced as the active light and tapas, the light and force of Ishvara, the Lord, in religion, in mythologies. What they called the ruler in different religions with different names, that is nothing but this truth will, this light and tapas governing the universe. At its level, the truth will is supreme. As it descends in creation, it goes through several stages of self-modification. After the Gnostic level comes the intuition. That truth, self-evident truth, it takes the form of intuition. And that intuition is there at every level. There is an intuition of the intellect, there is an intuition of the lower vital, there is an intuition of the submental. And what is intuition? The flashing of truth, the certainty of truth, is only a projection of the Gnostic truth, the Gnostic knowledge. At our level, the Gnostic knowledge can't function as things are. So it radiates itself in the form of intuition. When it is said, the supermind is there and the supermind is involved in matter, it is not a figure, because supermind really means the truth will. And if truth will bases the whole creation, necessarily it must base every form in creation. In everything there must be the supermind involved. And what we call intelligence, what we call a ray of consciousness or a spark of consciousness, regulating things, controlling and guiding things, is nothing but this working of the involved supermind. When we begin to be aware of it at our level, we call it instinct. Because it does an instinct, like the intuition, like the supramental working, does not proceed according to reason. It does not collect data and then arrive at certain conclusions. there is a spontaneous feeling, a spontaneous perception in the mind that this is so and this is not so. This is the, as a result, this is a result of the action of the involved supermind veiled behind mind, vital and physical. At the purely material level, we know that the energy that works in matter is self-directed. It leads to certain results. It may have a mechanical appearance, but all evidence points that it is self-guiding. It has an object and it reaches that object even without the intervention of a mind. We begin to get a greater evidence of the working of this light, of the working of this Gnostic consciousness, when the vital creation starts in the animal, for instance, at various stages. There is the right instinct to take to things that are favorable, we avoid things that are unfavorable. This intuition, which is active at the level of the animals, reaches its height in the higher species of animals. But as the human mind develops, the instinct, which is a veiled operation of intuition, which is a veiled operation of the Gnostic consciousness, that withdraws, and that is the direction of evolution, because it is the intention of nature that the consciousness has to evolve through the mental grades and not simply be directed by a blind instinct. As long as nature was following a certain course up to the level of man, this veiled intuition called instinct was a governing force. But once man has appeared, it is the mind that has to be developed. One has to work out one's own guidance, in other words, to become self-aware. And that is why at the human level, the instinct has receded into the background, and man, in working out the mental consciousness, he is now reaching out to the heights of intuition proper. And finally, there is a difference. Sri Aurobindo notes in the last paragraph, there is a difference between the supreme supermind as it is there and the supermind that is attained by the jiva, that is the human being. And that is so because whatever truth, whatever consciousness is attained, it has to be embodied and it has to manifest in the mold of the attaining jiva, the attaining being. Each jiva, each human being has its own mold, has its own nature, temperament, way of manifesting. And the Gnostic consciousness, the supramental consciousness, shapes itself accordingly and manifests itself differently through different individuals according to their soul type, according to their nature type. And this is the difference in the supermind as being and the difference between, the difference between the supermind as being and the supermind as becoming. Nature type is usually ordained by the soul type. The soul type chooses its appropriate nature mode. That is the ideal. And usually nature sees to it, universal nature, that each soul is provided with the nature mechanism that is best suited for its evolution. No. They didn't believe in that. When they retired, they felt there was no use. There was no relevance. The world had no more relevance to them. The world was an interference between themselves and their spiritual realization. So they chose to withdraw, and they never thought of this universe or perfecting the life or whatever it is. Such of those rishis, for instance, who did think of the world and who exerted themselves spiritually by emanating thoughts, feelings, impulsions that would lead to the progress of humanity, they can't be said to have retired or gone into retreat. They may have taken residence in forests for their own reasons, but they did continue to take part in the universal movement. Just as Sri Aurobindo did not go about in the streets, did not go and lecture to people, did not mix with people, shut himself in a room from where he did not go out for 20 to 25 years. But theoretically it is retirement from the human point of view. But actually he was more busy, more involved, more engaged than all of us put together. Isn't it? It will come later when we discuss the operation of the supermind, where the supermind, where the mind, the divine mind, let us call it. I may as well say it. What we call the divine mind comes into existence when this truth consciousness poises itself as if separate, not separate, as if separate, and observes itself there. It is fully conscious all the time. That is itself that is being observed, just as my hand I am observing. It is itself that is observing, and it is gaining its own knowledge at a particular point. That is called the operation of the apprehending consciousness, as distinct from a comprehending movement, an enveloping movement, and absorbing that knowledge. This action, apprehending movement, is characteristic of what is called the divine mind. And the divine mind is truly the progenitor of the movement that ultimately turns out to be the separative mind in ignorance. The last step on the borders of truth, the domain of truth, before it comes out and into the overmind, that is the divine mind. And that is the term into which our mind has to convert itself before it can enter into the poise of the comprehending supermind. Yes, there are three or four grades. We will come to that later on, I believe. Three grades, I think he speaks. Yes, he speaks of three grades of the supermind which the human mind has to do. We will come to it later on. Here he has described, I think, three grades of the supermind. Can you bring that? Let us see, I remember I have not noted it here. Life dominance.
Okay.
Right. We'll come to it later on. Yes. Interpretative supermind, intuitive supermind, isn't it? Interpretative, yes, interpretative, intuitive, and something else. Isn't it? Pardon? Illumined, maybe. I think the love aspect of it comes in the levels where there is the ananda, the delight principle, where in ranges where the supermind, in ranges where the delight principle is active, on the heights of this supermind, there love comes in, because love is an expression of delight.
Upon karma.
His own karma?
Yes.
Most of it would stand modified and cancelled. But there is a certain element in karma, what is called the ineluctable karma, which has to be gone through even by an avatar unless it is absolutely necessary for the divine purpose to cancel it, because it is a part of the rules of the game. If that ineluctable karma is not worked out, it disturbs the whole karmic machinery in the cosmos. So they have always chosen to go through and work out that karma. Even if it is in their power to dissolve that karma, they do not do it.
And avatar is karma?
Yes. Yes. An avatar has karma in two aspects. Whatever he does in the human body, it does register a karma. then to the extent he identifies himself with the earth being, he shares the universal karma also. Just as mother was saying during the later months, how falsehood from the universe was torturing her. She said the physical pain which she was having was nothing compared to the torture to which she was subjected when the universal falsehood was coming and striking at her. So this, what is this if not karma, the universal karma? She could very well have withdrawn herself and kept herself in a different poise, which she did not. She underwent it, she suffered it, so that karma could be worked out. Sri Aurobindo explains somewhere that unless it is necessary for the divine work, that karma is not cancelled, though the grace is capable of completely wiping it out. They will not have, supramental beings or the Gnostic beings will not have karma in our sense of the term. You see, whatever they do will be only positive karma giving positive results for others, rest of humanity. Karma comes when we do things with a motive, with a self. But when we are identified with the divine consciousness, and it is the divine consciousness that works through us, we don't build up any individual karma. So from that point of view, the Gnostic beings in a Gnostic community will not be building up terrestrial karma. They are only manifesting. They are only manifesting. If in the course of manifestation, if in the course of their contact with lesser beings like us, some karma is concocted, whatever it will be a superficial phenomena. Just like these godmen and people talking to us and they suddenly get angry, you see. That doesn't touch them. It is purely a reaction to what we throw upon them. It goes in that way. There is a movement of anger. There is a movement of disturbance, effect of disturbance in the surface consciousness. A little pain, it adjusts itself. That discomfort, that little pinpoint pain, it works out their wrong movement or inferior movement.
That the supramental community is functioning precisely to equalize and balance and overcome eventually the karma of the lower.
They are expected to pour out energies which will help humanity to get rid of their detaining karma and build up a strength for a positive karma. These are all speculations. We can say anything. But these are broad lines. Even a liberated man, let him not get supramental consciousness. A liberated man, a Jivan Mukta, when he lives, a Buddha lived, Maharshi lived, Sri Aurobindo lived, individually, they have no such karma by their life, in their life. But to the extent that they interfere with the karma of so many, even by way of help, they take on something of that karma on themselves. That is why the deaths, in death of most of these great people, there is pain.
No.
Why should it be excluded? They took upon themselves, whether it was Ramakrishna who died of cancer, or Buddha who had that ate that poisonous pork or something, and then he suffered. Maharshi who had cancer or tumor in the arm. Mother who have seen. But she underwent pain. She didn't die. She did not die, true. But she underwent inordinate physical suffering. Inordinate. Even a worst sinner won't have that much pain. How do you explain it? It is the collective karma of all of us which she took. Not only us means in the ashram, but outside people also.
Then as long as they're doing work in relation to the creation, they're subject to karma even though they have supermind.
Yes. Only there'll be always a certain mitigating process. But the universal karma is bound to fall upon them. But the spiritual reason is alone not enough. Why? Sri Aurobindo points out that